Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Hello, welcome to a special midweek edition for Art of Ayin, TD Geopolitics. I am really excited to be back, not so much excited to be back home, but excited to share our wonderful trip with you. I am joined by my junior, Timmy. You guys might have noticed this week, she hosted our own fantastic live stream with Ryan Milton. Got like 6,000 views the first day, which is like better than I do, I think. But thank you all for supporting her while we were away. And of course, my Iranian brother, Chris Halali, is joining us to be our guest host. I am so happy he's giving me the day off. So Timmy, tell us, how are you and how did you enjoy your first stream? And then we'll pass it over to Chris to take over.
Yeah, 100%. I was a little nervous in the beginning. I'm imagining everybody has those little jitters when they first start off. But, you know, Ryan is such a peach. He's close friends with Scott Ritter and he does a lot of work with him. So I just had like the loveliest person streaming with me. And God bless Grant for being there. He's my co-contributor. And he's a great person in terms of like having a discussion about military affairs and history. So he helped me have that discussion. And then I was just like, yeah, and I support Russia. And so it was really fun to have that discussion for the first time. And, you know, I feel like everybody was making really big milestones. And, you know, you guys with Iraq and then me streaming for the first time. So it was really cool.
And there you go, Chris. We're all yours then.
Well, good evening to everyone from here in Moscow. And of course, it's daytime still over there in the US. And on that side of the world, of course, big news coming up tomorrow. Of course, today, of course, is Arba'in, 14th into 15th. Of course, 15th is not only the Assumption of the Virgin Mary for all the Christians out there, but it's also the big Trump-Putin summit. But we won't get into that today. Today, we're going to talk about our amazing trip with my lovely sister, Sarah, over here, and all of this great crew of journalists and activists who were able to go to Iraq, to Karbala, on the road, to Arba'in, and of course, to understand really not only the history of Imam Hussein and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, but also to look at what's going on in Iraq at this moment, what's happening to the axis of resistance, and how Palestine remains not only the cause of the nation, but the cause of humanity. So to start this off, and I want to welcome everyone again, my dear sister Sarah over here, let's talk. Give us your impressions. What was it like going to Iraq now had you been before, and what is overall your perspective and your emotions after this trip?
Well, I think I'll play the video by our producer, and so they give their viewers a little bit of a visual, and you'll probably see our faces, or we're all like astounded in the video, like, and then we'll go into my previous venture into Iraq. But here we go.
الويل عباس بخيلك خلينا بجفوفك لا تسطر بيد الحومة لا لمسوينا قطعت الرؤوس وعلي عيدو ها 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 طف يا زلمة يعارك بيد طف يا زلمة
Let's just give props where they're due. Our producer put that together from my sloppy raw footage in 30 minutes. So kudos to Aria, who we dragged along on the trip with us. But the reason why I am especially grateful that I got to go to Iraq is because I was on a deployment in 2016 and participated in what we like to call the liberation of Mosul. We're not told anything. Chris would know from being in the military as well. You're not really told about what you're bombing or what you're really doing. And then you get to go there as a civilian and you realize, wow. So it actually exceeded my expectations tenfold. I expected, you know, the American myth of it being rubble and the people being poor and horrible. And it's the absolute polar opposite of that. Even that video gave me like goosebumps. That was the greatest trip I think I've ever been on. And there were some people that maybe thought we didn't do enough things, but I was just ecstatic to like drive around. There were points when in Karbala, we'll get into it, but like Aria was like, you're just smiling while you're taking videos because I couldn't stop just cheesing at how like profound and gorgeous this experience was. And to go from the dialectic of, or the dichotomy of serving to destroy that place. And then to go there and to see the people converge on it in such a beautiful way was like incredibly touching for me.
No, absolutely. And I think one of the important things, both Sarah and I had experienced some years ago, of course, Sarah in the operation in Mosul. And in 2017, of course, in January, I passed through Sulaymaniyah on the way to Kandil and Gare with the PKK, and then crossed over into Syria to participate in the war against Daesh alongside the Syrian Arab Army, Wagner forces, everybody. And on across the river, of course, was General Soleimani and Hezbollah and all the other groups, SSNP. So, of course, I mean, for us, Iraq, when I went there back in the day, it was a totally different environment. The security situation was radically different. I mean, we still had Daesh operating in many areas of the country. But thanks in large part to the Popular Mobilization Forces, the PMF, thanks in large part to the support by the Axis of Resistance, especially by neighboring Iran in its counterterrorism operations against Daesh and against these terrorists, which not only targeted Shia Muslims, but also, of course, the Yazidis, the Christians, especially in Nineveh and the plains in the north, also targeted Kurds and other minorities. So it was a very serious time. And now the situation is much more stable. People are practicing their faith traditions openly. And even with these powerful military forces that still remain, they are protecting Iraqi life for everyone. And so they're very inclusive. There's now no longer the same sectarian strife that we saw at that time, which, by the way, was fomented from the outside to try to stoke not only the tensions, but also to lead to the breakup of the Iraqi state. Of course, Iraq still remains unified. And it was amazing to see the progress, the development, the industrialization that's happening. A lot of new projects being developed. The road system is in good shape. And you can see that there's being repairs done constantly for that. And of course, it still has ongoing power concerns. We saw the electricity drop from time to time. But that was also due to the pressure that the U.S. imposes on Iraq from purchasing supplies from China or from other European countries when the U.S. seeks to maintain some firm hold. And of course, the U.S. has one of the largest embassies, if not the largest, that it has in the world, in the Green Zone in Baghdad. So, and it's not only an embassy, of course, it's a CIA listening post. It's also a military coordination center for CENTCOM and for the broader operations in Eurasia. So suffice to say, this trip really was an opportunity to see Iraq in 2025, to see the progress it's made since, especially, of course, the period of the quote-unquote war on terror. Of course, the U.S. still maintains a military presence, but every Iraqi we spoke to wants to see an end to that presence and wants to see a transformation in Iraq overall. So, Sarah, tell us, you know, for you as a woman being in Iraq, especially during this religious moment, Arba'in, this most important, actually the largest gathering and pilgrimage of Muslims, even greater than Hajj.
Bigger,
we're talking
yeah.
by tens of millions. Tell us what you felt like as a woman going into these spaces, because of course we have a lot of propaganda, but what do you think about it? How did you feel?
I actually intimidated myself more than the spaces where it was funny, because before we went, I asked the organizers, I said, would you like me to get hijab or abaya, or even, I'll even wear chador. I don't care. I just want to be respectful. I mean, I've stayed in Bahrain. I don't mind covering. And they like made fun of me. They were like, what are you talking about? This isn't Afghanistan. And I was like, do you want me to bring a covering on the plane? So when I get off the plane, I'm in Baghdad. I'll put on a covering while I wait for you at the airport. He was like, do not cover your hair. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, I mean, we would walk into places and most people were like, no, she doesn't have to cover. And I there were places where I was covering and people even told me to like take it off. They were like, you don't need to wear that. So I was kind of, you know, they tell us like Iraq is like some like fundamentalist Shia stronghold where the women are in full niqab and burqa and everything. And it's just not even like that. Like I went out and bought more like modest clothing because I was like, I don't want to wear tights or leggings or tight jeans or anything like that. And women were Iraqi women were dressed more provocatively than me. They're very modernized, very accepting. You can really see in Baghdad and even in Karbala that it's a lot of cultures converging. Everybody was extremely respectful in Karbala, not strict at all. I probably could have walked around without one on, but it would have been kind of disrespectful and I would have definitely been stared at. But yeah, I was surprised at how, I mean, they don't really touch you or hug you, but they talk and respect women just, and they engage with you just as much as anywhere else, for sure. You're not a second class citizen at all. You're not an afterthought.
When we went to that mall, I was so surprised. I mean, it was like the classic scene. Of course, some of the older ladies were wearing head coverings. And then you had this, like, you looked over and it was, I think, Levi and Rose or something. It was some, like, lingerie store. And it was just so open, so, you know, something that you wouldn't necessarily think of as being the case. But you saw a large portion of women, especially in Baghdad, no head covering, short skirts, leggings, you name it. And they were very, and you know, some of them even just sweatpants and a sweatshirt kind of walking around. It was very casual, very open. Nobody bothered, no morality police, nothing like that. Nothing like what I think some people have in their sort of Orientalist fantasies of, oh, Iraq, you know, somehow it's, you know, like Kabul. And it's not. It's a totally different society. There are many, many Christians. We saw people openly wearing crosses.
Oh, yeah.
They were very proud of their faith traditions. And I think that was something that is really good, especially overcoming the sectarian tensions that were very much apparent and instigated by the West, especially during the 2000s into the 2010s. Let me ask you, was this your first opportunity to see like Shia Islam up close and personal?
in its native habitat. But yes, like I know a lot of Shia. I naturally, it was funny because Sajjad, while we were on the trip, asked me what my religion was. And I said, Catholicism. And he said, perfect. Shia are just like Catholics. And a lot of my Arab and Middle Eastern friends are Shia. I'm close with a lot of Iranians, but no, I've never gotten, and you know, people always say, oh, Shia's different. You know, we have songs, we have a lot more like culture. It's a lot more colorful. It's a lot more, you know, outwardly. And when you get to see it, 25 million people, even before that, and I uploaded a few photos, these people take it upon themselves to just go do art, resistance art. This is a museum in a bombed out building where people just go and make art for Palestine, songs for Palestine. I mean, in the clip that you saw, the kids are singing. So it was very, and Imam Hussein, which I didn't know before I went, was actually quite focused on cultural stuff and education. And so I thought that was really, really neat. And that was my first time seeing Shia in a Shia majority country. So I didn't really engage much in Bahrain, even though that's a Shia majority country as well. But yeah, that was the first time. And oh God, I'm still floored from it. I'm still like recovering from the catharsis, I guess you could say.
And what was your reaction to seeing so many people? We walked down, of course, together those streets and that path from Najaf to Karbala, where a lot of people were doing their last sort of leg of the Arba'in journey. What was your experience? What did you feel being with all these women, men, children, elderly, just taking this long walk all the way to Karbala?
I don't think you understand, like, I don't think anybody that hasn't been there can grasp like the magnitude of what it's like to see a family with a camel that has walked from Basra to Karbala together for their belief. Like there's just, and I'm sitting there like 25 million people, a community comes together, they feed them, they house them, they quench their thirst. There's massages, there's places to sleep, there's places to get your hair cut for free. And I'm looking around like nowhere in the West would this ever even be thought of. It's like unfathomable, and it's all for their faith, Imam Hussein, Allah. And that's just something that is very lost on a lot of Westerners. You live in a very religious country now, so you probably get a lot of that vibe again, but it's very much lacking in the West. And I think that it was very palpable for me there.
It was a real shock. You know, I mean, okay, you know, you can see in some traditions, for example, philanthropy and people doing things, but to have 40 plus miles of just free food, free drinks, free clothes, free this, free that, free everything, you know? People just give you stuff as you walk. Yeah. You could start from Najaf and end in Karbala with like a new house, a new car. You know? It just feels like unbelievable, you know? It was like Oprah Winfrey on steroids, you know? Sort of, you know, everybody gets this and that. But, you know, it was all out of love. It was all out of love for Imam Hussein, for the Ahlul Bayt, as you said, for Allah, for the faith, and for the resistance. So we saw this, you know, people just, and we had the opportunity to hand out free drinks to people, and people were so thankful to grab drinks from us, to grab food from us, to interact with us. What did you think about that? Like, how did it make you feel to be part of that, to hand out stuff to people, to sort of see people interacting with you? Because some women, I think, came up to you and tried to interact, some girls tried to take pictures. Tell us about it.
The girls recognized me. The younger teenage girls recognized me. A few asked me if I was Billie Eilish. And then a few asked me if I was Jordanian. But I think I was kind of a curiosity. They knew we were journalists, but they were very kind. It wasn't like a voyeuristic, like, look at that animal. They were like, who are you? Where are you from? And they're so like adorable and sweet about it. Everybody was incredibly gracious. I was walking behind Jackson and Borut while they were handing out the drinks. And I think the two of them kind of felt weird and out of place, but I was behind them like, this is so cool. Like, this is so neat. And the people were like, who are these like white dudes here? But it was just oh my God. I loved the entire experience. But what about, let's incorporate Timmy a little bit into this conversation. I think you probably have something to say. I hope.
Yeah, no. Everything sounds fun and I'm kind of jealous that you guys didn't take me, but I just think that it's magnificent that you guys got to experience this because, you know, it does have a greater message to it. And like what you've been explaining has, you know, even because I was raised in the West, I come from like a Sunni family. So hearing about all these different like pilgrimages and what you got to see was is very touching. And what's really lovely to hear is that you guys obviously served, right? But you guys did a 360 and now you're civilians going to the very countries that perhaps, you know, historically, you know, America has had invaded. Right. So I am curious when you guys mentioned a little bit about how the Iraqis kind of embraced you, right? How the conversations went, what type of atmosphere did you guys see, especially with the fact that, you know, you mentioned that they want the Americans gone in terms of the American military and the U.S. bases. So, yeah, like if you guys could let me know a little bit about that.
Go ahead, Chris.
Sorry, you want to take it first?
No, you go. I've already talked a lot. Your turn.
I would say, well, first of all, I never deployed with the U.S. military. So all of them know that I trained with the U.S. military, was commissioned with the U.S. military, but resigned my commission. But they knew that my military experience came on the anti-Daesh campaign. And for them, that was like, we were on the same side. You know, they were like, oh, Habibi, you know, you remember those days, you know, the hard times and everything like that. So it was more like a fraternity, sort of like a brotherhood. And I got to experience that a lot with especially the PMF fighters, the people who were in the various militias in Iraq who fought in Mosul and in some other areas of the country, especially in the areas that had also Kurdish forces, like in Shangal, in Sinjar, where there was the campaign to destroy Daesh that was attacking the Yazidi people. So I felt a lot of like close proximity that this year, near year of my life that I spent in Syria and part of it in Iraq was on the same side as they were. And that felt good. And also it was sort of like, you know, if, you know, stuff pops up again, we're going to call on you. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I'm kind of retired, you know, but it was a lot of fun. It was great. And they were good people overall. They were very welcoming, very hospitable. And there wasn't that tension that we felt, I think that other people have felt before. I think also Sarah has a similar experience. Go ahead. Tell us about your experience there.
At PMF, or what were we? What are we?
Just in general, Iraqis PMF, but also the general Iraqi sort of idea about you having served.
They were curious about it, and they mostly were asking, "How did this trip kind of change your perspective?" I never had the sort of "we have to bomb all the Muslims" like ideology. I'm the type of person that always asks, "Well, why?" Mm-hmm. And if you like don't have a decent enough explanation, I'm like, "Well, then I'm going to go find out myself." And that's kind of what happened in 2016. I've told this story many times, but I was on a deployment. We were participating in the liberation. I'm sorry, guys. That's just what we call it. The liberations of Mosul and Raqqa, which both just decimated. And after those liberations or operations we had, they told us, you know, you need to go downstairs for training, which is something that you do on the ship all the time. So you go downstairs for training, and all of a sudden it's just clip after clip of our strike packages bombing who knows what with Little John playing in the background. And I was like, I'm part of this. Like, this is not even like, this is so bizarre. It wasn't even like, I wouldn't even feel like it was morally wrong. I was just like, this is like a death cult. And I was like, I just wanted to get out immediately. Then I started that's when I really started digging into the Middle East, and I got really involved with Yemen and then studying Syria and whatnot. And I wanted out immediately following that. But I think that for them in Iraq, they were very much, they kept always introduced us as the former U.S. service members, or at least me. And they always were kind of like, they weren't ever like, no animosity. They were like, well, how is this trip? What did you expect? How did it change your perspective, et cetera, et cetera. We were told these people were like Shia death squads, and anybody else who tried to join or even came across their path were going to be killed. But the group that I hung out with, they were Shia Kurds. So it was like, do they kill their half of their family? It was really interesting. And the reason why I really loved the PMF part and learning about the PMF is, and I said it in that video, so I won't go into too much detail, the video of Chris and I, but is that we don't talk about them. They're an afterthought after Hezbollah, Ansar Allah, Hamas. And then they're like, oh, Hashd al-Shaabi, like, or PMF out in Iraq. They're doing something. We don't even know. They're not, but they are highly coordinated, highly organized, and they are not Iranian proxies at all. They are very much sovereign in their own right.
Well, I mean, as some might know, that I'm taken over the DDGO Instagram. And by the way, so everybody please follow that.
Yeah, by taking over, she means posting every three days.
Yeah, she's lying. She just doesn't know how to use Instagram. She got locked out. Okay, but that's a whole different story. In terms of like a lot of the comments that I got when I posted the videos of you guys going to the PMF, you know, there was a lot of the rhetoric of how, you know, the PMF is a Shia death squad. There are Iranian proxies. You know, do you know how many Sunnis they've killed, et cetera, et cetera? And I'm like, guys, you are watching the Museum of Martyrs, right? You are watching like pictures and videos of people who have sacrificed themselves, right? And yet here you are claiming otherwise, right? And this is the issue that I have. So it's like, you know, in terms of your experience in talking to the PMF or like getting to know more about them, what are some things that you guys could even dispel? Because they think it's a Shia sectarian situation when, from what I've heard, it's otherwise.
No, it's very much otherwise. I mean, the PMF is a broad umbrella. It's not only Shia. It's Iraqi. And that was one thing they really stressed. This is an Iraqi formation. An Iraqi formation for Shia, for Sunni, for Kurd, for Christians of all the, you know, Chaldean, Assyrian, you name it, Nestorian, whatever they are. They are all in there. And that was very important for them to say that, look, we are not a sectarian organization. And we're not Iranian-backed. Are we Iranians supported through our history? Yes, of course, with military support, with technical support. Of course, General Soleimani was on the ground and was assassinated with Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis at the airport in Baghdad, right? But they were coordinating a joint anti-terrorism operation, right? They were trying to defeat a terrorist organization that was attacking and trying to take over Syria, Iraq, that was attacking in Iran, that was attacking in Lebanon, that was moving in Egypt, that was moving all over the region. Of course, Afghanistan, let's not even talk about, you know, ISIS, Khorasan. But the main thing really here is that PMF, right, Hashdashabi is a broad umbrella of various organizations, militias of a wide variety of ethnic and religious background. And I think that that's very important for people to understand. Those that continue to speak about Iranian intervention, Iranian occupation, Iranian influence are ones that tend to either have a more positive view of Saddam and the Ba'ath Party. And of course, that's a very complicated terrain because Saddam killed many of the Shia and many of the clerics and many people that we were with. Entire families were wiped out by Saddam's government because they were seen as either pro-Iran or pro-Shia in terms of insurgency against the government at the time, against Saddam's rule. And also on the other side, they might also have a more neoliberal or democratic, you know, with that kind of framework of the West idea of Iraq. Iraq should be more modern, more more pulled towards the West and not the East, and especially not to its neighbor Iran. But the main thing is this: Iran is a country of 80 plus million people neighboring it, and Iraq is a majority Shia country. They naturally are going to have close ties, right? And I think that that's very important to understand. And it's just natural for two main allies to be in the region in that way. But I think it's very important to dispel the myth and this sort of narrative that the PMF is somehow a sectarian, foreign-backed organization. That's the same thing that Israel uses, for example, against Hezbollah, without understanding that Hezbollah is a Lebanese organization, a patriotic organization for Lebanon, and it's Lebanese first in terms of its ultimate viewpoints and it's who it protects. Of course, it defends Palestine. Everybody defends Palestine at the forefront. And then everybody defends their homelands as well. All right. What do you think, Sarah?
Oh, I think it's important to stress. I mean, I met with the media team of PMF. I didn't get to shoot any guns or do any cool stuff the guys did. But I met with the media team. And I mean, we're talking that a media team went from 5 to 1,000 in 20 years. And now the PMF itself has 3 million volunteers at a time. You know, there's people in the comments that say, oh, are you going to talk about this? Are you going to talk about that? If people want to invite us and show us those things, then we will come home and we will talk about that. We're talking about exactly what we experienced. This wasn't a propaganda trip. They sat us down, showed us documentary footage of their time in Mosul, and then the actual person that was fighting ISIS and protecting a family and rescuing them from ISIS came out of the background. Like, it's called the popular mobilization forces. It doesn't have a religious name. It doesn't have an Iraqi nationalist name. It's called the popular mobilization forces of Iraq, but popular because everybody's in it. I mean, we met Yazidis, Christians, Sunnis, Shia. We met the people were Shia Kurds. I didn't even know that a Shia Kurd was a thing until I went to Iraq. I didn't know they existed. I was like, as soon as you become Shia, don't you just become Iranian again? And they were like cracking up laughing. But I was like, this is so incredible because you hear about these people. They're at each other's throats. They want to kill each other. And you're like, they're all right here. We're eating like hummus. Like, what do you mean? I thought that was pretty amazing. One of the viewers wants to know if in the PMF, did they have any fighters with green eyes that look like Tom Cruise?
We know it, Tom Cruise. We know it, Tom Cruise. We know Tom Cruise in the PMF.
And also, was Iraq safe? Which is something that Jackson actually did a video on in one of the side streets. You guys probably saw it. I believe it was on Oliver's Instagram and Twitter. But I felt safer in Baghdad than I would if I walked around at night in Seattle. I'm not kidding.
Absolutely. It was super safe. We went late at night, actually. My good friend Ali from Lebanon, who was there for Arbaeen and is now back, he works for RT. He called me up and we went out, and I actually went out separately from the group. Most of you were in bed. So I went out and Sajjad picked me up, and we were out from like 2 to 5 a.m. smoking shisha on a street that had been car bombed four times in 2 days and killed over 600 people, including the owner of the shop that we were at. His brother had taken it over. And this was during, of course, the main height of the sectarian conflict. It was so safe. So safe. Everybody walking normally. Nice cars driving. I mean, we saw Bentleys. We saw all sorts of cars. I was shocked. I was like, doing G-Wagons. G-Wagons, you name it, you know? And I want to say that it not only was it safe, the food was good. Ooh. That was another question. The food was great. The quality of everything was great. The hotel was lovely. The people, I mean, the stores, the general infrastructure, everything was much, much better than I had anticipated. What do you think, Sarah?
Absolutely. 100%. The infrastructure was incredible. The food, I lost weight. People were like, how did you go to Iraq and lose weight? I was like, there's no chemicals and crap in the food. I lost 7 pounds walking around and just eating normal food. And Syrian girl Mimi told us before we went, she was like, you will see that the generosity of the Iraqis is unmatched by anybody in the world. And I absolutely vouch for that. I have never, everything you ask, it is no problem. I will buy for you. I will buy. Like, you know, it is no problem. Why not? And they're just so gracious. And it was almost like they were just happy that we were there, that we even came. It was just nice.
Yeah, it was super nice.
Yeah, I mean, everything you guys are kind of like mentioning in terms of how you've, you know, interacted with the Iraqis is that they really wanted to stress that they're people, right? You know, the PMF is, you know, an Iraqi group that is for Iraqis, that these are human beings that, you know, that want to celebrate this, you know, great pilgrimage together, you know, and they also want to be hospitable towards anybody that comes into their country, because I think they've been demonized for so long, right? And I think Jackson actually put out a video, and he's 25, I'm 24. So when one of the last invasions happened, I was in high school, I must have been 15 perhaps. And, you know, I did see the images of, like, you know, decimated infrastructure, you know, a lot of people had passed away and been killed. And it was a rough image to see and to compartmentalize as a teen. But now that I'm seeing people who have gone back, and they basically have given this opportunity to see the very, very human side of, you know, Iraq, of Baghdad, of Karbala, right? It's very heartwarming, and it really changes your perspective, because I think for a long time they were either enemies to a lot, and then to a lot of the leftists, it's like, oh, well, they're vulnerable, you know, Like they just pitied them. But now it's like you guys are giving them an opportunity to be human to the rest of the world, right? And they really appreciate that.
No, absolutely.
I think that was a lot of what the trip was about. It was a lot about cultural exchange, which is that's my jam. I don't want to go, like, I'll meet your military. I'll meet your government officials. I want to be in the dirt with the people and the sweat and the nasty. And I want all of that. So I there's somebody in the comments that can't decide whether he's Iranian or Iraqi. And I'm like watching him have an identity crisis. It's really funny. But yeah, so it's just crazy. But I think that humanizing people is something that's incredibly important. It was something that we really strived to do right after October 7th was to humanize and tell the history of the Palestinians to make sure people feel connected to them. If you look around, what is the West currently destroying? They're destroying the collective history of humanity. These cults, they're destroying the roads to Damascus. They're destroying Armenia, our oldest Christian nation. They're destroying the Armenians inside of Israel. They're destroying Cyprus. All of these very old religious places that create cohesion. These things need to be preserved. Iraq is one of those places. It absolutely needs to be preserved. And I think the people are doing that because they're very true to themselves.
Absolutely. And I wanted to ask you another question that I think was important. How did you see, for example, because there's a lot of stuff going on in the chat, how did you see the Iraqi perspective on Iran and Iran's role in Iraq? What did you think about that?
They complained more about the Qataris being involved in Iraq. They didn't really mention much. I don't think that Iran has that sort of ability to project that far into Iraq right now. I mean, you drive down the streets in Baghdad, the main street, and it's a Qatari project here, a Chinese project here, an Emirati project here, which is great for development. But I didn't really see any palpable or tangible Iraqi influence. Even when we were in like meetings that we were talking about, maybe even geopolitics, they really didn't bring up Iraq. They brought up Palestine and Lebanon and Syria. It just didn't seem like much of a focal point. They respect it. They understand why they understand their connection to it, but they want to make sure that their dependence on it is kept at myth because it's just not. I just didn't notice. I didn't see anything that was very connecting them to Iraq. I felt like or Iran. I felt like they were more connected to the Levant than to Iran.
And even, you know, like the experience I had was most people, of course, you know, very quickly realized that I was Iranian and during the Arba'in pilgrimage, I mean, when I was holding out, you know, sort of the waters and the juices, and this whole group of of pilgrims came up to me and said, "Irani hastin?" I said, "Irani hastam." They started kissing me, "Ababa," you know, kissing me, hugging me. And I was so surprised. I was like, how did they even know that I was? Maybe it's like on my forehead.
I told you have the Iranian smile. You have the Iranian smile.
It must be. It must be, you know. But, you know, like it was something really welcoming. You know, we were, it was, and sort of like, one thing that I noticed online that I'd like to dispel now is the gatekeeping over who can go to Karbala, who can go to Imam Hussein Shrine, who can go see Imam Ali. These places are for all of humanity, okay? So I don't care if you don't think Jackson should go or Didi Geopolitics should go or whoever should go. Even the people themselves, the sheikhs, the imams, the ayatollahs, the marjas, everybody who was there who was a religious scholar said, and not only Shia, we had Sunni religious scholars with us. What did they say? They said, this place is for humanity. Because they came not for Muslims. They came for all of humanity. And they suffered and were martyred for all of humanity. Because the struggle against good and evil, oppressed and oppressor, is a struggle that all humans face and will face until the judgment and, you know, the coming of the Mahdi. So I think it's very important to dispel at once this idea that somebody here, whether they're Arab or Muslim, can gatekeep over who gets to go on Arba'in, who gets to go on Ashura, and to mourn on Muharram at that time period. This is for everyone. And that's really, really important to emphasize. And the people themselves said it. The people themselves.
We have pictures of the Christians inside of the shrine. Obviously, I didn't get to go in the shrine, but there's pictures of Christians in there. What are you going to police 25 million people? Should we get a roster? And that way you could go through the nationality and religious background of each one and make sure that you know who's who. And the funniest part is, you know what? I'm not even going to get into it because I don't want to get offensive. But yes, I agree. And that was the vibe down at Karbala. And then when you come out of that sort of pink cloud and then there's people like, you're not supposed to be there. You're like, you really don't get it.
You don't get it. That's like the opposite of what the meaning is supposed to be, mm-hmm. which is one that is unifying and bringing everyone together. Speaking about that, I want to get to when you got home, like on the way home. So you left this beautiful place that brought people together, the mm-hmm. unity, the sacrifice, the importance of what it means to be a martyr in the modern world. And you take off from Baghdad on your way back home. Tell us about your journey back home.
I went to Istanbul, my favorite airport in the world. Big up to Turkey. You can do air travel. Love you for that. Flew into SeaTac. This is my first time re-entering SeaTac. I did some research about customs, find out how long it is, what their procedures are like, etc. I usually enter in JFK. That's a good one in case you guys, because they see so many people that they're usually like, just go. Like, but they were waiting for me. I got to passport control. You walk up to a sort of a screen and your face is scanned, and it was scanning my face. It scanned my face like 100 times and was like, face not recognized. And I was like, okay, I don't even know what this thing's doing. The lady said, go over there and another officer will be with you. The guy looked at me, scanned it, and was like, we're going to x-ray your bag. And I was like, all right. And take me to the back. They pulled me up to like this counter, sort of like a cubicle, but it was surrounded by a metal like bar counter. They put my luggage on it and started ripping it open. I was dealing with multiple people at once, but they were asking me why I went. But what I thought was interesting is when I came to the counter, they had all pictures of you guys. They had Haas and Jackson, the picture of them in the two red chairs. They had the picture of you and I inside of the museum. They had other pictures of Haas. They had pictures of when that meeting that you, you, Jackson, and Borut attended that I didn't. They had the three of you sitting there and they were like, what's this? They pulled out my luggage and they started to go through remember what the Sheikh gave us, those beautiful wooden gifts. And they found the folder of him. The best thing about me is that I don't ask questions. You tell me to be somewhere at 9, I'll be there. I don't need to know where we're going. I don't need to know what street it's on for this reason specifically. So the guy pulled it out and pulled out the folder and he's like, we're interested in this guy. And I was like, that's cool. Me too. He was like, where did you meet him? Was it at his house? And I was like, absolutely not. Like, no, it was in a public government building. I mean, look, and then they started asking me questions about ACP. They wanted to know, they were asking, they said to me, it set me off because they said to me, did you travel there alone? And I said, of course. Yeah, I always travel alone. I'm the only one that's idiotic enough to live on the West Coast in this business and fly the extra 6 hours. But then they said, what about on the way back? And I said, yes. And they were like, well, we know someone was with you on your trip from Baghdad to Istanbul. And I said, nobody was with me. They were like, who wasn't another American with you? And Haas was with me on that flight. They had been watching Haas and myself the entire time, probably mostly Haas. When I was at the counter, they mentioned the American Communist Party by name, not ACP. They said American Communist Party. They asked me if I was in it. I'm not a party member. And I made that very clear. And they asked questions about you and they asked questions about Jackson. They want to know, they also asked questions about Nasrallah's funeral. So these people have been studying you guys for a while. Because the funeral was in February or March, somewhere around there.
February, yeah.
So, they asked about that. I was obviously incredibly shaken up. I was searched, you know, my person was searched. My phone was confiscated. There's really nothing of consequence on that phone anyway. After everything subsided and like the trauma and the like anxiety, and I really started to talk about it with people, I think that they're really going after the ACP because they wanted to know where your chairman was, what kind of trips he's been on. Do I know who funds him? Do I know where the money comes from? Where do I get my money from? Do I track my donations? Like, just they really wanted to know about ACP. So yeah, it was incredibly violating. It was scary, but you know, you get through it. It's not going to make me stop talking ever, ever, unless they kill me. I'm never going to stop talking. So,
and it shouldn't. You're a journalist. You have every right to go to these places and to report on the facts and what's happening on the ground. And once again, this is an attack on journalism. This is an attack on our freedom of speech. This is an attack on our freedom of the press. And ultimately, this is an attack on our basic rights to be in various political formations that do not advocate the violent overthrow of the U.S. government,
no,
but that seek to confront U.S. imperialism just by speaking about it openly and publicly, which is everybody's right in this country.
Well, and I want to ask you, and Ari and I discussed this a little bit, because Haas came through. I think he was questioned a little bit, or maybe like held up for a few minutes and then kind of brushed on his way. And I thought, I I'm always a person that after I get upset about the what or I get over the what, I really want to know the why. And I was like, that's really interesting that they knew we were traveling, not together, but they were tracking us coming home. They knew when both of us were entering, when and where, and they let him go, but they pulled me. It was almost like, I thought maybe they detained me, one, because I'm a woman and it's easier to get women to talk, two, because I'm not in the leadership of the ACP, so I would be less likely to protect them. And that's kind of, and I don't have any information on the ACP, and I did that on purpose because I don't want to ever lie to authorities and I don't ever want to be put in a position where I'm forced to rat out my colleagues. So I don't know anything about the inner workings of ACP, and I prefer it that way. And that's also why I'm not a party member, not because of the platform, not because I don't like the people, but because I said, I think it was Timmy that actually asked me, why don't you join the party? And I said, I think it would be bad for both of us because something will happen and they'll turn us against one another. And I just don't want to, I want anything like that to happen. And I'm glad that I was psychic about that, but I thought that that was really peculiar that they pulled me and they didn't pull Haas.
They did pull Haas. Actually, what happened in Haas's situation, and he called me shortly after he got back home, was that the officer was waiting for him outside of the door of the plane.
Whoa. So,
yeah, okay. Which is what they used to do to me and still do to me, but I haven't been back to the US for some months and don't intend on coming back with this political situation, at least in the short term. But what happened to me since 2013, especially when I went to China to study there for 2 years and ended up going to the DPRK, was once you get off the plane, they're already there. Either they say on the intercom, you know, Christopher Halali, please come up to the front. You're exiting first. And then they grab you from there. Or they wait and they do passport check. And once they grab you, all the officers follow you. So that's what they did to Haas. And the person had done their research. They knew. They took his phone. But I'm going to give this as a pointer to everyone here. Make sure you clear your phones. Do factory reset on your phone. The government can't access your phone at this point. So he had taken care of his phone and they didn't seize the phone because it was factory reset. So I think it's very important to understand that we are being targeted because we are bringing and shedding light and bringing information to the American public that isn't in the mainstream media, support the narrative being shaped by the Zionist lobby. We are supportive of the resistance. We are supportive of the Palestinian people in their right for self-determination and national liberation. And we are supportive of many of these groups in the region trying to rid themselves of the yoke of U.S. imperialism. And so if that makes us criminals, then we are criminals for violating our own principles, because we are not doing anything wrong. We are doing everything in line with our constitutional principles in the U.S., but they want to show that somehow we are violating those, and we're not. We're not doing anything wrong. We are doing simple journalism. It might not be journalism that they like, of course, because it's not part of their agenda, but it is absolutely in line with our values and what we believe as journalists to be bringing the truth and the facts from the ground to the people.
I also think the organizers were good about keeping us away from anything that could incriminate us. I mean, they took the phone probably for the images on it because there's really nothing else on it, but I'm going to share most of them anyway. I didn't take any pictures of anything that was shady because I really didn't see anything shady. I think that they were kind of mindful of that. And he even said a few times, like, I make sure that I worry about the safety of America, of the people that are on this trip with me. I don't want them to get in any trouble, especially the Americans. You know, things can be taken out of context and stuff like that. And I think they were very mindful of that. And I'm, you know, you're thinking in the back of your head, because, you know, the number one fear is like, well, what did I do that could be illegal? But then it's like, we didn't. I just went to a country that where I was advised on maybe not going for safety reasons. And I went anyway. That's all we really did. And look, we went to some museums and a religious pilgrimage.
Absolutely. And I want this to be an important point for us to show our viewers, all of this ongoing propaganda that we somehow are agents, that we somehow are intelligence, that we somehow are operatives of the US, or even some people claim of Israel, of Mossad, they are dispelled because when we come back to the US, we are subjected to some of the worst treatment, to some of the most invasive practices, to harvest information from our phones, to harvest information from what we know, and to ask us 1.5 million questions, to detain us, to strip search us, to take all of the items that we brought back and to photograph them and catalog them and put them into a database. I want people to understand that we are subjected to this inhumane treatment, and we are still labeled by some who have the comfort of their mom and dad's basement. We are still labeled as somehow being some asset of the US government. That couldn't be further of the truth. And it's something that I find to be very disingenuous at best.
And I mean, so Chris, I think now both, I think we're like Eskimo brothers with the CBP, because we've both been fully searched and detained.
Been fully searched. I did tell them if they search me that way, that I charge. They didn't find it too humorous, but I had to throw it out there.
I have traveled for 20 hours. Are you sure you wanna do this? Like, this is going to be disgusting.
But that's true.
And that's why I posted that thing on Twitter. I was like, I don't want to hear a GD thing from anybody talking about I'm censored and I'm shadow banned. I can't get my voice out there. Try having your everything searched, your luggage taken pictures up, and your phone confiscated. And this happens every time. I'm 2 for 2 in the last year. I was detained in Russia, and I was coming back from Russia, and I was detained coming back from Iraq. And this is every time.
It's every time for me too. And just so everybody knows, after 9/11 and the Patriot Act, you have not only at the port of entry, but 100 miles into the country from any port of entry or any land border, sea border, you name it, your constitutional rights are not fully protected. You are under a different type of constitutional regime, which of course is part of the increase in heightened security measures taken by the US government, approved by the Congress, supported by the Supreme Court, to search you without a warrant, to take your phone and electronics without a warrant, to ask you questions without a warrant and without the presence of a lawyer. So I want you all to be aware that you have less rights at the border, and this regime and this oppressive apparatus that we have created, not I didn't support it, but of course many Americans supported it, this apparatus is continuing to be used and enhanced against those who go to Russia, who support China, who support the resistance, who support Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, who support the African countries that are fighting against imperialism and colonialism. So I hope everybody really understands that this is something that's affecting those of us who are at the forefront of trying to bring not only analysis and news, but stories from the global South, especially from the multipolar world, especially from those fighting against Western hegemony, to you all and to the world. And you see what's being done with us. And they're interested in our context, because ultimately they're interested in creating a web, because what are they going to do with that web? They're going to strike the people that they can strike. They're going to take out the people that they can take out. And they're going to try to sever our ties as much as they can. But we can't allow that to happen. So everybody, I want to reiterate, make sure you're keeping up with security culture and make sure you're protecting yourselves, your friends, and your comrades.
And I also want usually our viewers are pretty highbrow. We have a decently high IQ audience. Guys, pay attention to who is calling us agents, and then start to look at who they're kind of associated with and who they work for. It's very curious. Go ahead, Timmy.
I had one incident online, actually, where this happened. I'm sure you know who this probably is, Chris, but it's a specific individual that's been going after, you know, the infrared and ACP sphere for quite a while and been doxing us. They accused me of being an asset and being funded by the U.S. government. I'm Canadian, number one. And number two, I'm only 24 years old, so they're not getting a bang for their buck. Let's just say that. But there was a very interesting thing about that conversation, because they were explaining to me in detail of how USAID works, right? And that can only pretty much happen unless they're either working for the government or they're in the government or whatever it may be. And I just, it's something had clicked. And I realized these are the people that are accusing me of being a Fed and being paid by Feds. They can very concisely tell me how USAID works and how they get essentially paid by all of this. And I was just like, am I dreaming right now? And I have screenshots of this to this day. It's very much something that I documented because I thought it was fascinating. But yeah, like I've gotten accusations myself, which is ridiculous because who's going to pay me to shill for the government? But yeah, it's harrowing to see what happens to you guys. I haven't traveled as much yet. But, you know, I hope to go to Russia sometime soon. Let's just say that. And I wouldn't be surprised if we'll see what happens with Canada. We'll see. And I'll be there. I'm down. I have no issues with that.
So as we sort of close out this stream, you know, we've gone almost an hour now. Tell us, you know, sum up your experience, sum up the whole trip, and let us know what's in store. What are you looking forward to in the future? What do you see for yourself, the region, and what do you hope listeners and our viewers can take away?
Well, interestingly enough, the trip renewed my vigor. I would go through ruts just like everybody else. I probably tell Aria that I'm going to quit at least once a month, or I'm done at least once a month. But that trip has probably filled my gas tanks for like the next at least six before I even have the thought cross my mind. And even with the detainment and the horrible violation, I mean, I was incredibly traumatized for about 24 hours. And then, you know, you kind of just, you're like, all right, you have to make a choice. What's the choice? And I'm like, well, there is no choice. You got to keep going. So don't like, you just got it. So it actually renewed my want to go even harder. Like, I'm like, I still want to go to Lebanon. I still want to go to China. I still want to do all of it. I don't care. I have a plan now. I know what to expect and I'm ready to go. I still want to do all of the work that we're meant to do. And going out to, especially seeing the children, the second time we went to Karbala, that was all I needed to see. I was like, that's it. I'll just keep going forever until I literally can't go anymore physically. That was what that trip did for me. I've been reporting on the Levant and the Middle East for 4 years now. I've been to some parts of it, the Gulf. But that trip alone has like solidified why I put myself through what I put myself through to get whatever information gets out into the world. I don't get paid. We were invited to Burkina Faso. I don't get paid. We aren't sponsored. We don't get anything for this. And so those rewards and like seeing things like we saw in Iraq, that's the payoff. That was enough. That was more than enough. And the trip was so great that the horrible detainment, and it was horrible, I forgot about it in a day. I was like, just think about the trip. Like, and that trip really, like, Iraq gave me life. That's corny and whatever, but that trip gave me so much life. It really renewed all of like my desires to want to keep going. I would go back tomorrow. If the flight wasn't 18 hours, I would go back tomorrow in a heartbeat.
I agree. I feel the same. I feel very much the same. We're going to keep doing this because ultimately I think that this trip, every time we go on a trip like this, but more importantly, every time we see people in the region who touch us, who grab us, who tell us their stories, who kiss us, who hug us and really want us to share their world with other people, it makes me stronger. It builds a stronger armor to say that we're all on the path of Karbala in a way. We're all on this path of resistance. And if that leads to some point where we have to sacrifice some things, whether it's our comfort, whether it's detainment, whether it's who knows, that's very important for us to take
exactly
on.
Exactly that, and it's the necessary. Comfort thing. And I'm sitting there exactly what I'm thinking. Of course I'm upset. Of course I'm crying. I'm a little worried about my phone, whatever. But I came from somewhere where 25 million people walked 20 miles. to get to a shrine. Who am I to sit there and cry over an iPhone? Exactly. Or when we met the Palestinians, who am I to sit there and cry over whether the food is good or not? Like, exactly. They just give you so much perspective. And I think that's needed. A lot of people need that.
They absolutely do. I want to thank you again for all that you've brought to this great discussion, for your experience, for being such an awesome friend, travel partner, comrade, everything. It was an amazing experience. And even though some people asked if it was hot, it was very hot. It was well over 100 degrees.
Oh yeah.
It was rough at points, but we made it. We enjoyed it. I look forward to many more trips together in the coming years to come. And I want to thank all of our viewers and listeners on this stream. And I look forward to our continued work together and the work that DD Geopolitics and overall our movement is doing to bring you the voices, the perspectives, and the truth from the resistance, from the global south, from the developing multipolar world. Thank you all very much.
And I'll leave you guys, before I pass it off to Timmy to take us out, I will leave you guys with a book recommendation. I read this before I went to Iraq, and going there, I feel more confident about recommending it. It's called Chaos and Caliphate by Patrick Coburn, who's one of the best journalists on the Middle East anyway. But it's fantastic. Chaos and Caliphate. All about Iraq, a little bit of Syria, a little bit of Libya in there as well. Really seriously read it. It was great. And I can vouch. Now I feel like I'm way more confident in recommending that book. And if you ever even get the hint of an invite to Iraq, take it. You will not regret it. You will not regret it. It's only going to get better as long as the Americans don't interfere again, I guess. But Timmy, thank you. You're growing up. Close our stream for us. Let's go.
All right. Well, thank you once again, Chris and Sarah, for inviting me to listen into this because, you know, obviously I've been in the backyard looking at like the pictures and the videos and posting them on Instagram. Once again, follow DD Geopolitics on Instagram. But it was very interesting to hear about your guys' experiences once coming back, along with Haas's and everybody else's. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do this work. And I'm very grateful and honored to be a part of all of this because it does mean a lot. You know, I hope to be the new generation that, you know, passes the baton to the next and the next and the next generation, right? So this was a lovely experience. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening in and tuning in. And hope you guys spread the word. Once again, have a good one, guys.
براياس عيال الموت يصيحون لو قبلهم ينعب جوت بس خل نتنفس قالوا لفحت الخيل شفنا احنا الويل عباس بخيلك خلينا بكفوفك لا تسطر بي في الحومة تلال مسوينا قطعت الرؤوس وعلي عيدو ها 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 طف يا زلمه يعارك بي طف يا زلمه